Welcome to the Sobriety Plus Group Saturday Night Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Jeff, and I am an alcoholic. Could we have a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We're glad you're here, especially the newcomer. Is there anyone here in their first week, first day, or first month of sobriety who would like to introduce themselves, just so we can get to know you better? Anybody? No? Okay, is there anybody from another group that would like to introduce themselves?
I'm Martin Ellis. I'm an alcoholic, and I just moved here from Starbucks, and I'm just finding me.
Great. Welcome. Glad you're here. Anybody else? No? Okay. At this time, I'm going to... The group conscience asks that you have 1 year continued sobriety to chair this meeting, which I do, and I'm going to read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I could find it. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Okay, and this is introduce the speaker. I met Jim at the College Park Triangle and heard him share many times there. And then I had the fortune of getting asked to participate in a 12-step study that he was in. And I really got to know him there, know him as a person, and the work he does in sobriety. You meet people and you see them, you know, and how they talk in meetings and then how they talk and how they act outside of meetings. And, I know he's been through a lot this year, and to see him rely on his program and his reliance on God to get him through it, it was just remarkable. And, he lives this program, and I'm grateful to have him here. So, Jim.
Jeff, thanks for everybody being here tonight. When Jeff asked me to speak, he told me that, on the east side of town, we talk about recovery a lot. And I said, well, it'll be a short meeting tonight. But I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002, and Central's my home group. And I'm really, really honored to be here tonight for a couple of reasons. About this time, 42 years ago, the co-founder of this program, Bill Wilson, died. And 42 years later, this program's going strong. And I think that's really a testament to the people who follow the directions as outlined in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to follow that as best I can. I'm going to tell you in a general way what happened, what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. And I'm going to get to recovery pretty quick because that's the most important part of this program. It saved my life, and it continues to save my life every day. I was the fifth of six children in an Air Force family. My father was an Air Force hero. He was not an alcoholic. My mother was not an alcoholic. My sisters aren't alcoholics. And I had two brothers, and Jeff knows that both of them are dead now. And both of them are dead as a direct result of alcoholism. I was the black sheep of the family, I guess you'd call it. I didn't like the strict military discipline, and I can remember when I was 7 years old and we were stationed in Japan setting a field on fire because I wanted to see what the field would do when you set it on fire and it burns. You know, and I continue to burn things today, but I do it a little more carefully since I'm a volunteer firefighter up in Georgia. I moved all over the world. Our family moved every couple of years, and none of this is the reason I'm an alcoholic. But I never had any more than like 2.5 years at any one location. So just as I was meeting people and getting friendly with people, we were packing up and moving to another place. We came back from Japan and moved to Tacoma, Washington, and I was what they would describe in the book. I was way restless, irritable, and discontent with my life before I ever had alcohol. I had a habit of lying, and I don't know anybody else that has that habit when they're young, but, you know, I just couldn't tell the truth. And one of the things that happened to me because I had that habit was two friends and I were coming home from school one day at McChord Air Force Base in Tacoma, and we caught this little mouse in a field on the way home. And, you know, we kind of put it in one of the lunch boxes, and we were playing with it, and one of the kids got nipped on the finger with it, and he took it home with him. And on a base, you know, news spreads pretty fast, and the first thing you know, his mother calls my mother, and my mother comes in and says, "Did you get bit by that mouse?" And I went, "Yes, I did." Well, I didn't, but I just thought, you know, maybe I'd get out of school. And I didn't get out of school. What I got was to go get rabies shots. And that was a direct result of my lying, was I got to go have a rabies shot every day for the next 11 days, because back at that time, they didn't have health departments around to find out if the rat had or the mouse had rabies. They had to send it to Washington, D.C., and usually it was 14 shots. I had 11 of them, and they were the most painful thing that I can ever remember of that time in my life, and it was just because I lied, you know. The next year we moved, and I lived in Duluth, Minnesota, and I always tell people, if you have a chance to go there, pass. It is the coldest place on earth. I know Mike's here tonight. He grew up in Michigan, and Duluth's colder than that. So we were there, and my oldest sister was getting married. I was 11 years old, and at the reception, the colonel said that everybody could have a sip of champagne. And, you know, we toasted my sister, and all my brothers and sisters took a sip. And I just chugged that glass of champagne right down, and something happened. A guy named Bill Oakley used to say, you know, it was a golden moment. Some people call it that magic moment. I don't know about all that. All I know is it did something to me that it doesn't do to normal people. It made me want more. And I decided that I wanted more right then, and so I snuck back by that little champagne fountain, and I got more. And I got about 5 or 6 of those in me. I gulped each one down, and then I started spinning around, and I guess my parents realized that somebody had too much to drink. You know, that one little sip affected me, they thought. And, you know, they put me to bed, and I was spinning around in the bed, and I remember to this day, you know, the feeling of man, I can't stop spinning, and stomach spinning, I threw up, and when I came to the next day, I had the worst hangover I could ever remember. There was a little man with an anvil sitting in my head just beating away, and I could taste that stale vomit, and I had peed on myself, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And normal people don't think that way. And I'm 11 years old. We moved down here in 1966 from Minnesota, and I was 13 years old. And the only thing going through my mind, I had no interest in school, I had no interest in cars, I had no interest in anything. I had an interest in getting drunk again. And I didn't have an interest in working. And so I started hanging around with guys who were about 4 or 5 years older than me. And we got a little group of us together, and we realized that we all like to drink pretty hard. And I started drinking really hard. And the way I got my drink was to break into your house to steal your stuff so I could buy my booze. I didn't want to work. And I started doing burglaries around Central Florida for the next 4 years. I've made amends enough times in speaking for the past 11 years that I really don't need to make amends anymore. I don't know why I feel compelled to say that if I broke into your house between 68 and 72, I apologize. But if I did, you know, I really don't know. I don't know what I did a lot of times because I was in the Black House all the time. I started progressing after that. I found that picking up a gun and carrying a gun was more important than just breaking in a house, and I started doing armed robberies. And from the age of 13 to the age of 17, I attended very little public school. Most of my schooling was done up on Michigan Avenue in a place called the Juvenile Detention Facility. I kept getting caught, and there was never any consequences that I was worried about. The only consequences is when I was getting caught going in there, all I could do is think about, well, when I get out, you know, I'll do things differently. But I'm still thinking about getting drunk every time. And that's where I was living my life. It was a really bad thing to do. It was a really wrong thing to do. But until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know that I was a sick person. You know, alcohol had already taken control of my life. It was telling me to do things that I wouldn't have normally done, I don't believe. I was raised to know right from wrong. I was raised in a family that did right. And I just, you know, it was just something that happened. I stopped going to juvenile home at the age of 16, and I started going to jails. And I'd get picked up, and I'd get bailed out, and then I wouldn't get caught for a while, and then I'd get picked up, and I get bailed out. And then it came to the time where I got picked up when I was 17 years old, and my dad said enough. And he let me sit in jail for a while. And I wrote a letter, and I found that letter a little while ago. And I can't tell you how many times right now, I tried to remember to write down how many times I said, I promise I'll never do this again. I promise I'll never do this again if you get me out. But it was about a 4-page letter, and after about 2 months of being in there under a pretty high bond, they lowered the bond, and my dad relented, probably because of my mom, and they released me. And that night I broke into his gun cabinet, and I stole the .45 automatic that he carried through 3 wars, and I took off, and I headed to California. And all the way between here and California, I was doing armed robberies. And when I got to California, I came down with a disease, a drug addict, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I, trust me, there's only a couple people in this room that love the traditions more than me. Drugs are a big part of my story. In the 60s and early 70s, drugs were rampant in my life. But because of the traditions, I'm going to focus on alcoholism because that was there in the beginning and that was there at the end. But I did everything except crack cocaine. And I got serum hepatitis from a dirty needle when I was 17 years old. And they had wanted posters at the Navy base and all the bases around the United States because I was a felon with interstate flight to avoid prosecution hanging over my head. And I checked into I was actually thrown out of a car by some friends in front of a military base in California, San Rafael, California. And the first thing they did is they looked at me and they rushed me to an isolation room. And I almost died. And I don't know why I didn't other than the grace of God. And I can tell you that I did not come from a religious family. We didn't go to church on a regular basis. A couple times a year we got all dressed up and to impress the other people on the base, I guess. But I was not raised with a God. I wasn't raised against a God. I wasn't raised for a God. I just never had one until I came here. I spent about 6 to 8 weeks in a military hospital, and I recovered from that hepatitis. It was pretty horrible, but I did recover. And as soon as I got out, I started doing the exact same thing again, all the way up to Minnesota, Minneapolis. I got arrested in Minneapolis, got out of that one, came back to Florida, knowing I was wanted, but I thought I could sneak back to Florida to a friend's party up in Maitland. And apparently the Maitland Police Department, Winter Park Police Department, Orange County Sheriff's Department had an informant in our group, and they were waiting for me. And they raided the house, and I had just done a bunch of phenocyclidine, plus drinking a whole bunch of alcohol, and I was crazier than a loon, and I had a gun. And there was a guy at the bottom of the stairs pointing a gun at me, telling me to drop mine, and I was pointing my gun back at him, telling him to drop his. And his name was Ed Doyle, and he just recently, a couple of years ago, retired as chief of police of Maitland Police Department. And I don't know why he didn't shoot me. I really don't. He should have. I was arrested, taken back to the Orange County Jail with no bond, and I had hepatitis again. I was in an isolation cell, and I was orange as could be, and it was, I was knocking on death's door again. And I went before a judge. I just turned 18 years old. I went before a judge, and he said, based on your history and based on your unredeeming qualities, I'm going to sentence you to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida. And I'm 18 years old. And I hear about fear all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I love when people talk about fear because it reminds me of the fear that I had standing in that courtroom that day, that an 18-year-old boy going to Rayford was not going to come back. I knew what Rayford was. And I went back to that cell, and I didn't realize until I was doing inventory with my sponsor, when he asked me, you know, what was the first time that you realized that God came in your life and answered your prayers? He said, take your time, you know, take a couple days and think about it. And it was in that cell, because the only book in that cell was a Bible. And even though I wasn't raised religious, all I knew is, you know, I grabbed a hold of that book, and I just started praying to God, please don't let me go to Rayford. Please don't let me go to Rayford. And after 2 weeks, I was called back in before that judge, and he had a change of heart. And he says, I'm going to sentence you to 18 months on a chain gang. And in Orange County, we had a chain gang back in 1971 and 72. They didn't have chains on your legs anymore, but they had guards at each end with a shotgun when you were in the ditches. And you see these prisoners today with weed eaters and things like that. You know, you didn't have that in 1972. If you see the movie Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman, that's pretty much what I was doing. And I'm just coming out of hepatitis. They got me on a road gang. And I'm out there every day for the first month almost, falling out every day. You know, in the summer heat, it was July, in the summer heat, you know, trying to work that swing blade in that ditch, moving it up, boss, I couldn't do it. And every time I fell out from heat exhaustion, they would pick me up and put me under the truck. You know, they didn't call 911 and take you to the hospital. You stayed under the truck until the end of the day, and they took you back to the prison camp. And I saw the progression out there. You know, here I am being punished, and I should have been punished, you know. But here I am, instead of thinking that, you know, I need to learn my lesson, I saw the progression of what happens if you do the right thing on a chain gang. You can get off the road crew, and you can get into the building. And there was just this little square building out where 33rd Street is right now, and that all the rest of that was pasture land. We grew our own food, we raised our own cows and hogs, and what I saw was the kitchen, you know. I wanted to get into the kitchen, and so I did my best to get into the kitchen and become a cook. Because if you're feeding 150 people three meals a day, and I already knew this, I don't know if I told you, I'm from Georgia, you can take the ingredients that are in that kitchen and you can put them in a can, and you can put things in that can and you can let it ferment on a shelf for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and you can get hammered, and it's the nastiest tasting stuff you ever had in your life. And that's what I did. I made what they call buck and sold it at night when I was allowed to make my rounds of the cells because I was a trustee. I just wanted to get drunk. You know, I'm being punished, but I can't think of anything but getting drunk. I got out of jail. I avoided being arrested very many more times. It was only a few more times before I said, you know, this is getting old. I moved to a little town in Mississippi and met a little girl in a drunken haze, and we got married. And she stayed with me for 21 years. And I drank every day, and I drank to get drunk every day. And she was not an alcoholic. I wasn't a violent person, but I know I harmed her verbally. You know, and I've made my amends to her now. We moved back here. I got a job with my father. I made amends to my father when I was 26, and I got into real estate. And I followed my father's advice. He said, don't drink during the day. Don't drink with your clients. And I said, okay. And so when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous many years later, I couldn't really believe that I was an alcoholic because I had a nice job. I made a lot of money. I had the house on the lake. I had two cars in the garage, you know. And what I knew about alcoholics and alcoholism is you all were under bridges. You were sleeping in the woods. You didn't have anything. And I was really ignorant of what alcoholism is and what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Both of my grandfathers died from alcoholism. My grandmothers were saints, but both of my grandfathers were raging alcoholics, but my family did not talk about them. They were never brought up of anything. And never did my parents say, I think you got a problem with drugs or alcohol, I'm going to send you to rehab. I missed the emergency room, detox, rehab, treatment center, whole deal. You know, I was 44 years old when, after having a little boy, who some of you know, because he's been raised in the rooms pretty much any time he's with me, he's with me at a meeting or with me when I'm with guys, named Forrest. And I loved that boy dearly. I mean, that's all I ever wanted was a son. But when he was 4 years old, my alcoholism was so strong that I gave him away. And what happened was, and it doesn't happen to a lot of people, but it happened to me, is I started drinking so hard. My marriage was crumbling around me, and I was still getting up and going to work every day, but I was really drinking really hard. I was drinking for the effect produced by alcohol, just like the doctor's opinion says. And one night, my back was hurting me, and I took a couple pain pills that my sister was taking for the cancer that she had, and I drank real hard, and I came out of a blackout with this woman screaming at me that you're peeing all over me, you're peeing all over me. And I'm a grown man, you know, and I'm like, no, I'm not. You know, that's a lie. Peeing all over myself, and she was next to me, and she was getting the effects produced by alcohol, which was, I lost control. You know, my body was no longer my body, it was alcohol. And that happened over and over until she wouldn't stay in the same room with me, and she wanted a divorce. And I don't blame her a bit today. And I told her she could have a divorce, and somehow or another, I was drunk when the divorce papers were served, and when I came to a little while later, I had agreed to give my son up for another man to raise in Mississippi. And God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I was not qualified to raise a son at that point in my life. He deserved to have a father that cared for him, and he's got a fantastic stepfather who I've told more than once that I appreciate what he's done with my son. I was told by my stepmother that, you know, I had a problem with alcohol. I needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. What did I know about Alcoholics Anonymous? It was a bunch of people in trench coats that were drunk all the time. That's exactly what I thought. And I had no clue where one was. I worked right on Colonial Drive, kitty corner to Central. And every morning I'd drive by and I'd see a bunch of people standing out front smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. And I thought, what a strange place to have a labor pool. It's right there on Colonial Drive. You know? That's what I thought it was. You know, a little house that's not there anymore. And I called the guy and I said, you know, I don't really want to go to a meeting, but a friend of mine just committed suicide, and I made a promise at that funeral that I'd go to one meeting and tell all those drunks that if they didn't quit drinking, they were going to kill themselves. And so he said, there's one right across the street for you. They've probably been waiting, you know. And I'm like, ooh, right across the street, you know. I don't want to go see somebody I might know. And he goes, yeah, well, that probably ain't going to happen. Yeah. Well, I stumbled into Central, and sure enough, there was one of my clients sitting there going, yeah, he could have been here a long time ago. I can use his last name. He told me he could. His name was Dick Stultz, and Clarence Snyder was his sponsor. I broke out in tears. I told everybody if they didn't quit drinking, they were going to die, you know. And I'm sitting there. Today I look back and I feel how stupid I was, because I think John was there maybe, or maybe Chet or somebody, but I know Leo was there, and some of you might have met an old man named Leo. And he took a shine to me, because I was pretty much a hopeless case when I came in. And after about 27 days of coming into that meeting and swearing I wasn't going to drink, and I knew I was not going to drink that day. And I went to a new meeting every day, and I just broke out in tears to say, I can't stop drinking. And old man Leo said, why don't you go home and drink a bottle of arsenic? I'm tired of hearing you brag about how you can drink, you know. And that old man made me so mad. The first time in 37 years I went home, and I didn't take a drug, and I didn't drink any alcohol. And I started this road called recovery on a resentment, because I was so mad at him. And those of you who know the program, you start a road of recovery on a resentment, you're not going to stay sober, and I didn't. I would get periods of what I call sobriety, because I really was trying. I wasn't doing anything you told me to do, but I was really trying on my own will not to drink. You know, and then I started, you know, God didn't scare me away, because I didn't have one, and, you know, I just started praying, you know, keep me away from a drink, and, you know, the next day I didn't have a drink the day before, and the next day I didn't have a drink, and after about 90 days, you know, I'd say, all right, I feel great, and I'd pick up a drink, and I'd black out, you know. People kept saying it's the first drink that gets you drunk, and I thought, God, what a wimp, you know. But, you know, if I ever heard the full explanation of these things, I probably would have, you know, got this program a little quicker. But every time I got drunk, the progression of the disease was exactly what the book said. It got worse, but it got shorter. I stayed out a lot shorter each time I got drunk. And then I got to the point where I was pretty good at lying to y'all in the rooms too, because somebody would say, well, you got a sponsor? And I'd say, I do. And, you know, me. What step are you on? I'm on step four. You know, you've been on step four for the past 6 months. Well, yeah, it's kind of tough, you know. I wasn't on any steps. I was planning my next drug. And I didn't know it. But in the back of my mind, I had not smashed it. I had reservations that I could drink again one day. And I went 9 months without a drink. And I wasn't miserable like some people get without a drink. Like my older brother who quit drinking but didn't want a spiritual way of life. Went to meetings every day. I was praying to keep away from a drink, and I wasn't drinking. And my life was getting good, and I was feeling great. And a guy asked me to go to a speaker meeting at Central, and in the old house, there was a little wall back towards the rear of the main room, and you couldn't see the speaker, you could hear him, and I was watching the speaker, and a guy up there was telling my story, drinking Schlitz malt liquor, doing this, and he was just telling my story, and I was bobbing my head up and down, and the guy who brought me said, you know, that guy would be a good sponsor for you. And I really wasn't looking for a sponsor. You know, and afterwards, he said, why don't you go up and shake his hand? And a big crowd around him, and I said, well, maybe later on. And he goes, no, right now. And he kind of walked right between everybody and moved him out of the way. And I took this guy named Joe's hand, and this other guy said, this is my friend Jim. He needs a sponsor. What do? You know, I'm stuck. And I said, hey, you told my story. You know, I really appreciate it, and I want what you got. You know, would you sponsor me? And he said, are you done drinking? And I said, I'm done drinking. I'm sure I'm done drinking. I'm pretty sure I'm done drinking. I thought I was done drinking. And this is where God started real clear in my life. I took out my business card, and on the back side of it, I wrote down my phone number. And I handed it to Joe, and I said, why don't you call me Monday if you want to sponsor me? Yeah. He took out his business card, and on the white side, on the back side of his card, he wrote down his phone number. He said, why don't you call me Monday if you want me to sponsor you? You know? And we turned over those two business cards, and we worked for the same real estate company in two different cities. I had never met the man before in my life. He worked in Winter Park. I worked in Orlando. And I just knew right then that wasn't a coincidence. The guy was putting my life for a reason. And the next day I went to a 10 o'clock meeting, and I felt great, you know. And on the way home, my car pulled into an ABC And I said, you know what? I've been without a drink for 9 months. I feel great. I'm going to start recovery on Monday. And I picked up a half gallon of whiskey because I said, I'm going to have one drink. Now, this whole time, you know, I could look up there at the board and I could see this powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable when I drink. That's what I read. That's not what it says. But I read into a lot of the stuff. And I went home and I took that drink. And I remember pouring one drink and drinking it. And I don't remember anything else that happened. Until the next morning when I came to on my kitchen floor and I was covered in puke and pee and blood. And I didn't know who I hurt. And I knew I'd hurt somebody. And I was in a panic. And after about 10 minutes, when I came to, I realized that it was my blood. That I had hit my head passing out, falling down on the kitchen floor. And quite a few of us die that way. And I called Joe, and he heard that sound that we look for when we sponsor somebody or when we try to help somebody. He heard that desperation. And he said, pour out the rest of your alcohol, go to your noon meeting, which I didn't want to do, pick up a white chip, which I didn't want to do. And he said, I'll meet you afterwards and we'll start working the steps. And that's what we did. And it's been a tremendous, tremendous life. I can't tell you all the different people that have had an effect on my life. Bill Oakley was a real strong, strong effect on my life because he would say little country things like, you know, bring your dreams to AA, you know, bring your drunk dreams to AA and see what happens. You know, you can't get there from where you ain't, you know, and things like that that I could associate with. And we started doing the steps, and we did them out of the book, and I was taught that it is a textbook. And I was taught to read from the very beginning and not add any words and not try to assume what the words mean. If I don't know what the word means, get a dictionary and look it up. And we started working them pretty quick. Joe was not one to stand around and say, take your time with number two. You know, for almost 3.5 years, I was not insane. And so step two just couldn't apply to me. You know, how could I be restored to sanity if I'm not insane already? Well, how can you pick up a half gallon of whiskey to have one drink? That, to me, is the definition of insanity. And so I knew I was crazy when it came to alcohol. You know, whether or not I had a great job and I was smart and I had all these community service things, none of that mattered. What mattered was I couldn't stop drinking on my own. And you couldn't help me stop drinking. I had to find a power greater than myself in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to find one, and I did. I found God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, my God, my personal God. And that's what really has sustained me for the past almost 11 years. You know, I went through the steps, and I didn't fly through them. You know, step four to me was a real eye-opener, because I had always said to myself, there are things that I have done that nobody is going to hear about, you know, absolutely nobody. And so I didn't write them down, and I wasn't going to tell them. And this guy just had something about him that, you know, we sat down to do a fifth step, and he said, did you do a thorough inventory? And I said, yes, I did. He said, did you write it all down? I said, no, I didn't. He said, well, let's talk about it. What didn't you write down? And I started pouring my heart out and telling him things, you know, that only he needs to know about. But I did it the way the book says, you know. God already knew about it. I knew about it. But there was something about telling another human being, you know, my deepest dark secrets that freed me. Now, I didn't feel this great relief. But I did get the promises that come in the fifth step. You know, I was able to look at people. I was able to hold my head up. I was able to do things that I was so ashamed of. And he kept telling me, you know, you're not a bad guy. You've been sick for a long time. And you're not going to get well overnight. And I realized exactly what he meant, that it was going to take a while for me to recover from the hopeless state of mind and body that I brought with me. I love 6 and 7. You know, two little paragraphs in the book. I wasn't allowed to read the 12 and 12 until after we did the 12 steps. And I found in the 12 and 12 a lot of information. But I realized, you know, today that 6 and 7, the prayers that are there, are to encourage me to keep doing the action of Alcoholics Anonymous, to get into the writing down the people that I had harmed and become willing. Willingness is the key to my recovery today. Am I willing to do the things I did yesterday? Yeah. Am I willing to get down and pray in the morning? Am I willing to read some of the big book and a couple other books I read? Yeah. It worked. It worked back then. It works today. And I realize that each day that when God wakes me up, it's God's day. It's not Jim's day, you know. My day is full of selfish and self-centeredness. But if I wake up and I realize that the book says upon awakening, you know, I ask God for direction for the day. And I don't quote the big book. I just generally say what I believe it says to me. And so I don't get up and make a cup of coffee. I don't get up and go to the bathroom. I don't pee in the bed anymore. I take a nap. But, you know, but when I wake up, I realize that God's woken me up. You know, whether it's a dog barking, whether it's a car horn, whatever it is, it's God waking me up and giving me another 24 hours. You know, because I should have been dead a long time ago if it was up to Jim. And upon awakening, I ask God to give me direction, to keep me away from a drink or a drug, and not to hurt anybody today. Because I don't want to hurt anybody anymore. And I realized when I did my inventory and I did my amends, the number of people I harmed. And, you know, it wasn't all the people that I physically harmed. It was the mental harm that I did to my family. It was the mental harm that I did to my ex-wife. Because I could get real loud. I could get real verbal with her when I was drunk. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a hateful, mean person. It's just alcohol did something to me, and it turned on me. The rest of the steps, you know, everybody who's been around, I didn't see any newcomers here, so apparently y'all have either read the book or know a little bit about them. You know, 10, 11, and 12 are, you know, my daily maintenance. You know, I really don't want to hurt anybody. And so making amends is not something I really have to do very often. But I still make mistakes. You know, and I make mistakes not on purpose. It's just sometimes, you know, my selfish self-centeredness comes out without me even thinking about it. I've got a friend who talks about, you know, some of us are missing a filter. And I miss that filter sometimes, you know. I get a thought, my mouth moves, and the next thing I know I'm going, geez, you know. Now I got to go back and say, you know, I really didn't mean that. I'm sorry. You know, and today I can say I'm sorry because I don't harm anybody like I used to. You know, all those times when I was stealing from those people, I thought I was stealing their stuff. Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about peace of mind. And that's what I was stealing from all those people. When they came home and they found their house trashed and all their things gone, you know, their things could be replaced, but it was the peace of mind that I was stealing. And that's what I wanted. I wanted peace of mind. And that's what you all gave me. You gave me a design for living in this book. And you gave me a God that can handle all my problems. You know, I thought alcohol was my problem, and it's not. You know, I stopped drinking. I got a lot of stuff to work on. You know, mainly it's my selfish self-centeredness. And that hurts me more today. You know, when I get caught up in self today, I still hurt. I still do things that I regret. But I don't dwell on them. And I really don't try to hurt anybody. One of the things I did is I brought my dreams, like Bill said. And one of my dreams was to own a few acres up in Georgia so I could pass it on to my son. I wanted to leave him something to give him a start in life. And, you know, like I said, he's been to thousands of AA meetings. I go to mostly closed meetings. And so he grew up at the coffee bar at Tenet Central up in Albany, Georgia. They have a little house, and they have a separate room for kids. He grew up there in Mississippi. They have a meeting at the University of Women. It's a little house, and they've got side rooms. And so, you know, if it was a closed meeting, he was sitting in the other room. And I never knew until about a year ago how much he absorbed through those walls. You know, there were times where he'd be staying with me in the summer, and he'd say, "Dad, don't you think you need a meeting?" I'm like, "No, let's go." You know, and sometimes I'd pick him up after camp when he was in summer camp, and he'd go, "How was your meeting today?" And I would go, "Great." And one time he said, "I can't wait till I grow up and I get to go to that place." And I'm sitting there going, "No, I don't want you to go there." And he goes, "Why?" I go, "Well, why would you want to go there?" He says, "Because you tell me that you help each other and you don't drink and you talk about God. It sounds like a fun place." And, you know, out of the mouth of babes. He was 8 years old when he told me that. He's 18 now. A couple of months ago he called me. And a friend of his was in the emergency room in a hospital. And he was doing a 12-step call. Pretty cool. He's never drank and he's never taken a drug. Yeah, that's pretty cool stuff. And that's because of y'all. When I was up in Georgia, a little over 4 years ago, I got a phone call from somebody down here who said, "Your little brother's in a coma." My little brother and I hadn't talked for a long time. After his fifth DUI, he got a monitor bracelet on his ankle that monitored his sweat glands for alcohol, and he was going to go do 5 years in prison if he ever drank again, so he stopped drinking. And I brought him to some AA meetings, and he picked up a white chip, and he got a big book, and then he finally said, "You know, this just ain't for me, Jim." And when I got the call, he hadn't had a drink in over a year. And he was in a coma. And I said, "I'll be right there. You know, I'm the go-to guy in my family when I got sober." And I said, "I'll rush right down, be right there." And this person said, "I'm a friend of Bill W.'s, and I've heard you speak." And, you know, right then I knew I didn't have to rush down here. I had somebody I could trust that would take care of my little brother. So I got my affairs in order up in Georgia, and a couple of days later I came down, and my brother had 10 tumors. And they were all a direct result of what he did to his body with alcohol. And he wanted that bracelet off his ankle, because he was going to have to go through 10 radiation treatments. They weren't going to do chemotherapy, and they gave him 6 months to 2 years to live. So I took him to the parole department. I told him what we were going to do. We made a bucket list of all the things we were going to do. And they said, "Okay, we're going to just cancel his parole. We're going to take the bracelet off." You know, I had all the medical forms proving what I was talking about. And on the way home, I said, "Let's stop by Central and hit a meeting," and we did. And he was there for about a half hour, and he said, "I'm really hungry. Can we go get something to eat?" And I said, "Sure." And while we were having lunch, he ordered a glass of wine. And I said, "You know, that's just a bad idea, you know. You're going through all this radiation, you know, it's just gonna get worse, man. The book says it's gonna get worse." He goes, "I just want a glass of wine." I said, "Well, you know, okay." And then on the way home from the restaurant, he said, "Can you stop by the ABC? I'm just gonna get a bottle of wine and then I'll just sip it for the next few days." And I'm thinking to myself, man, this is gonna be bad. And 30 days later, I was holding his hand when he took his last breath. He was 10 years younger than me. You know, I came in when I was 44 years old, and he died when he was 44. Because he didn't want a spiritual way of life. He didn't want what we have, you know? And there's so many of them out there that don't want what we have. And it's sad, but it's life. I came back to Orlando when that happened, and I just re-energized into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was a meeting 8 miles from my property up in Georgia, and they talked about cottonseed and tractors. And, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere. You know, they just now got 911 up there. And it's answered three counties over, so they don't really know where you even live. But I couldn't survive that way. And I was coming down here almost every weekend or every other weekend and getting a meeting down here. And then I found a meeting over in Albany. It's called the Central Albany Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was formed 1 year before Central Orlando Group was. And I would drive 60 miles one way so I could get a meeting, you know, of literature, of big book, of talking about the steps and what they've done in our lives. And then when I moved back, I got really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then about a year ago, I lost a really good relationship. I started to go bankrupt. And I got a great idea. And boy, when people tell me I've got a great idea, I roll my eyes too. But the great idea was, you know, I needed something for my son to want to do. He's not really great at school, but I don't care. He's in school, you know. And so I decided to go into over-the-road trucking. And I don't know anything about trucking. I don't even know where the oil stick is on the car, hardly. But I did. Down in Winter Haven, I went to school, and I did really well. And I became an over-the-road trucker. And there's a guy in here that I work with that I thought I was going to be driving and then stopping, driving and stopping. And that's what the company told me when they hired me, and they stuck me in the truck with somebody that was a mad dog driver, and, you know, the wheels were not supposed to stop as far as he was concerned. When he slept, I should drive, and when I drove, he was sleeping. And we stopped 4 times in a month and spent the night somewhere. 3 of those times were because of the snow on the road. And it was the most stressful, horrendous job. I remember a guy in here saying, "Jimmy, I don't think you want to do that." And I said, "Yeah, I do, Mike." Mike was right. I didn't want to do that. But each time we stopped, I would text my my friend back here, and I'd say, "Hey, I'm in Youngstown, Ohio." And in about 3 to 4 minutes, I'd get a text back, and they'd have a hotline number or an intergroup number. And the 4 times that we stopped, I called that number. 4 times, somebody drove to the truck stop and picked me up and took me to an AA meeting. You know, Youngstown, Ohio, I thought we'd have the greatest AA meeting. It was kind of a different one. They aren't bad. They're just different. You know, but Cheyenne, Wyoming, Sparks, Nevada, you know, Sacramento, California, four places we stopped, I went to meetings. The problem with me was that my body has gotten to the point in life that it can't take vibrations as much as I want it to. And I started developing kidney stones while I was on the road. And you know, the first one you pass it, it hurts. The second one you're thinking about it, you pass it, it really hurts. After I passed the 6th kidney stone in the back of a truck, I decided that was, Mike was right. I shouldn't be doing this. And I went to the doctor and he said, "Your kidneys aren't going to take this vibration any longer. You need to stop." And so I got off the road. And I found myself back at home again. I found myself back at Central, back at College Park Triangle, back with friends and family that I really love. And I really miss, you know. I love being on the road. I love going to other meetings. But I didn't get to do it enough, you know. And having a whole pile of speaker tapes and keeping in communication by text and phone, it's not one-on-one, you know. It's not the way it's supposed to be, eyeball to eyeball. That's what I need. I need to be in a room of alcoholics to understand what I'm going through. And this past November, almost 4 years to the day, I tried to get a hold of my older brother up on our property in Georgia. And, you know, he quit drinking to save a job. And then he retired. And he never really drank very much at all. After he retired, every now and then he'd buy a bottle, he'd drink it, and then he wouldn't drink for months and months and months. And normally he would return a phone call within 24, 48 hours. Sometimes he'd be a jerk and not, but I started calling him because I had a friend who wanted to go up there. And the third day I was calling him, I was like, "Look," I'm not going to say the word I called him, but it wasn't a nice word. I said, "Look, you know, you're trying to be a jerk about this and not answer the phone. I'm coming up on Friday, and I need you to call me back. And unless you're dead, I want you to call me back." And when I got there on Friday, he had been dead since Tuesday. And he had all kinds of health problems that neither my sister or I knew about. and it was all untreated alcoholism as far as I was concerned, because he wouldn't go to the doctor and he wouldn't take care of himself. And I was afraid I was going to find him on the property somewhere, and I found him in his bed. But the trauma that happened then was pretty severe to me. And the first thing I did was call my sponsor. And then I started calling my support group, because that's what we're taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not always going to be able to get a hold of that one person, so you need to build up a group of people. And I've got a group of people at Central. I've got a group of people at College Park. I got people here. I got people all over Orlando. My phone's full of numbers. And almost every one of them behind that name says AA, you know? And that's where my family is. The more my family dies, the more my family grows in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you all are my family. You know more about me than my family does. You know more of what I've been through. And my sister and I, she lived an hour away, and she would have been the one I called to go find him had I not gotten up there. And I was really glad that I didn't have to do that. But we didn't talk very much. She was the one that really didn't like me very much for what I put my family through. And I started having some really bad grief dreams, is what they call them. And I shared them with a couple of people in here. And one of the things that I learned was to listen. And one of the people told me about the surrender beyond the surrender. And I've read the book A New Pair of Glasses. I know it's not conference approved, but I don't care. And I realized what he was talking about, the surrender beyond the surrender. That I had to give it to God, and I had to take my hands off of what was going on. And I went back to Georgia, and I spent 2 weeks doing inventory of my brother's house, because my sister wanted to sell everything. And when the time came for us to be appointed co-administrators of my brother's estate, something happened to my sister. Yeah. I want to say something happened to me, and I know it did, but something happened to my sister. She changed. And even though it's not peaches and cream today, we're closer than we've ever been. This happened for a reason. And she and I talk and text 3 or 4 times a week, where it used to be maybe once a year we'd, check in and say, hey, are you alive? Something like that. And it's all due to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God working in my life. I really believe when I got off that truck, that I got invited to this big book study, because I needed to go back to that book line by line. I needed to study the textbook and refer back to it. I was told that from the very beginning. This is a textbook to be referred back to over and over and studied. And I got to do that with 11 other gentlemen. It changed my life. And it prepared me for what was going to happen. I have a lot of gratitude. That's why I break up when I speak, is because of the gratitude of what you all have put into my life. You gave me a chance to find a God so I could realize what I was missing for 44 years. And I have a great life. I get in the way of it sometimes, but I can tell you this. I know that I don't want to drink. That's the furthest thing from my mind. And I know I don't want to hurt anybody. I heard a gentleman here recently say something, and I used his name once, so now I can steal it. He said, I know what I'm doing between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. What am I doing between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer? Bill Wilson said this program is not to be worked, it's to be lived. What am I doing in my family, in my job, in my community? How am I carrying myself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous when nobody's around? I hope I do what y'all have taught me. Thanks for letting me be here.